So for the last talk of the day, we have Sebastian, who will tell us about, I guess, big data and astrophysics, right?
So, hi everyone. The original...
So, do you want to just turn on the power to the back of the microphone?
Put it up. It's my God.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
so originally I was titled for Canadian Astronomy Data Center Tools and Analytics for Large Dataset. This is still what I'm going to talk about, but I slightly changed the title into this because I also will talk. Given the audience, I thought we'll talk about something how to actually we measure distances using supernovae. It's something that's been working for quite a while now, although less so the last few years. So first, let me introduce how we do things at the Canadian Astronomy Data Center. So we mostly data archiving and discovery center. So it doesn't mean that the data is dead forever, or contrary. It means that the data is there for you, for astronomers to discover and do a lot of things with that. And one clear example is, for example, if you take the Hubble Space Telescope publication rate, most of the publications since, I would say, 2003 or so, has been from the archives. So clearly, there is a need for the archive to play a role in the data, in the discovery domain of astronomy. We host the Hubble Space Telescope with an archive as a mirror, among with many others. I will show you. So just back to how it started in 1986 with the Hubble Space Telescope. First, the data would go to the Space Science Telescope Institute, fly over to the CADC in Victoria, and there will be people there actually putting things on disks, on tapes, loading into a database, and some remote astronomer would connect to this with a little terminal querying the system, the database, like that. And then we will send you over the data. Now in 2018, things have grown up. A lot more data has come, not just the Hubble Space Telescope. We host, I think, 12 different telescopes and many other data that we call data collections that are surveys and collaborations. Who wants to share the data with us that we can host and it can be discoverable by our tools? So, and then here we play a more like a service place and also an infrastructure place where we can host the data, index it, and then we can also make sure now that for the data coming from telescope is properly preserved among many, many years, but also from we make tools for big collaboration to collaborate on the same data, share the data, sometimes it's protected, sometimes it's private, etc. Which is quite important in astronomy. And also, we try to help individual scientists who just want to play around with the data. And the data being so large these days, I guess it's someone told me that 80% of the jobs is just moving data around in astronomy now. So really, we're not there yet, but we try to make it easier. I think the next few years will be even more important with the data deluge, what people say, with the radio data especially. So we have we try to put the data in a few different places in Victoria, and then we have collaboration with Compute Canada to make copies of the data and also for the processing, such that the data is sort of closer to the processing as well. So we offer the services and on infrastructure to try to make it as friendly as possible. So this is what it looks like. Web page is about outdated. But, we have all these telescopes and instrument, Evans Data products, which are sometimes some people here at CDC make they're really good specialists on taking care of one big telescope like CFHT, for example. That was on the Hubble Space Telescope as well. And then this is, once it's all indexed, we try to make it a common, what we call a common data model, for all the data to be searched, discoverable in the same way. So the data we're talking about with this tool is actually mostly observatory data, exposures from telescopes and things like that. And then here you can search it by, I guess, what the most important thing is that in astronomy, time, space, wavelength, and energy, but also polarization, actually, which will become more important with the radio. And so far, we've been hosting only our data, that we've been indexing only the data that we have hosted, but just there's been a really large push from the astronomers to say, how can I search, for example, M87 in all the astronomy archive in the world, which could be X-ray in the Chandra, which could be CFHT on H-alpha, for example. And this, so we've been trying to do something to index actually external data from the archive and then make it searchable this way. But the data will still be hosted in other archives. So the delivery, we deliver all this data to the users. We host ourselves about, I think it's about 2 petabytes right now of data, replicated 4 different ways. And this is, we deliver all around the world. Mostly, it's not about the quantity of data, it's more about the heterogeneity of the data, which is a little harder to deal with. It's very manual intensive to actually normalize all the data into the same format. So you have to understand sort of what the data consists of. And then many, many small files, which make it a little more difficult on a storage perspective. So lately, I guess since 2010-ish kind of thing, we started collaborating with universities more to see how we can do and compute Canada and Canary originally, to how we could make the research happen remotely. So people want work with on a laptop, they can still play with ALMA data, which can go up to two terabytes just for scratch space. So things like that make it a little more difficult. So we're trying to set up a cloud environment for the astronomers like that. So it's been working in production since 2010. And so far, people have been storing data, 40 different projects have been doing batch processing and all these kind of things. And we're trying to reach a fair, this is not really well shown here, but there's pretty much all topics of astrophysics there. The big chunk is the processing that we do for our own processing systems for CFHT mostly and HST. So one example is something that, for example, Pat was involved with the Next Generation Virgo Survey, which is a picture here that we see on the sky. And this is the CFHT, the Canadian France Hawaii Telescope that we can see here. So now switching gears, I'm going to talk about what we can do with all this data anyway. So I thought instead of doing talking about too many tools, I'm just going to talk about modern tools that I've been playing with the last year. And it's been quite interesting. So obviously, I'll let you decide which one is which here. But so there is this big hype about big learning. Obviously, you've heard about it. Is it really interesting for astronomy? What can we do with it, really? Is it something, does it open the discovery space for us? So in a nutshell, deep learning, what is this? So it's not artificial intelligence, it's more whatever we can call it, augmented machine or so in an it started in the 80s and in the 80s and 90s there was this big push with artificial intelligence, and especially with various different methods of, and for example, neural network, and there was support vector machines, boosted decision trees, a whole bunch of different things, the methods that people were trying to try to automate things with. But then there was this big desert where people say, oh, it doesn't produce any result, what's going on? It's quite boring. But meanwhile, the compute and the data really augmented our capacity to do things. So what happened is now these methods that people developed in the 90s and later on started to be actually applicable. So we could do things which people thought about back then. And neural networks is one of them, which sort of picked up because it sort of scales with both the model and the data size. So now, for example, back then, people would take their data, do some feature extraction to try to reduce as much as possible, classify those features, and then take get some physical output from that. Now, the idea of deep learning is hopefully with enough computation, enough model, you increase your model with many, many more parameters, and then maybe you can skip that painful feature characterization that you used to do. So, do astronomy cares? Well, here is an example of the astronomy talking about deep learning, not just machine learning in general, but deep learning papers. As you can see, deep learning really was resurrected in 2012 for something called ImageNet. I can talk about it, but I won't. But really, the last 2 years has been quite dramatic. And actually, there's not so many papers from Canadian astronomers, unfortunately. But it might be picking up this year. Also. Mostly, it has been used for detections. One thing I think quite interesting is when you have really computing intensive simulation, you can try to emulate the simulation, like, because deep learning is and really, really good interpolator. And all these, what I'm going to talk about is how to automate some human error prone analysis that a lot of astronomers used to do. And the nice thing is, you have really well-written software to play with, so that really helps breaking the barriers for students, for example. I'll talk about a few projects that we've been exploring with deep learning. It just started last year, so some of it you will see very experimental modes. But you know, I'd like to hear what people think about this AI stuff. Around here too, it'll be interesting. One of them is the classification with extremely large survey. In astronomy, these days is the in optical astronomy, in infrared astronomy, well, even now it's going to be pretty much everywhere. You have extremely large large surveys detecting billions of objects, and these objects has to be characterized. And they're coming from different instruments, and they're hosted in different places, different archives. That makes it not only you have to cross-match them, which can be easy when the signal-to-noise is high, but can be much difficult when the signal-to-noise is low. You have to de-blend the object, and then you have to also move the data around, which is another problem which is not solved here. So we can do a simple one here, just from classifying from four different large survey whether those objects are a star or a galaxy, for example, which is actually or QSO, which is extremely useful for cosmology and for also the study of the Milky Way when you want to go find extremely our star and distances much further than, for example, Gaia is able to give. So the Canada-France Imaging Survey, for example, was started about two years ago now, I think. And it has it's mapping about 4,000 square degrees, I think, more now so far. And it's mostly in the U-band, ultraviolet, and then it also has the R-band, which is a really great complementary of some other surveys that exist, which is the Pan-STARRS, which is a telescope, dedicated telescope to survey in Hawaii, surveying on a much larger area, but lacks the ultraviolet. Or the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is an earlier survey, just like the combination of those two, but much shallower. That doesn't go deep in the sky. And then furthermore, you want to map it out all together with the late release of Gaia, which is this space telescope that mapped about 1.7 billion objects in the sky. Anyway, we're trying to cross-match this. And for example, you can see the distribution of the U magnitude. So think this is at flux. Distribution of flux of things you can know for sure, the star galaxy or QSOs, and things you have no idea about. So those in orange, for example, is the label one, and the label which you sort of know what she's about. And then the blue one is the one you're trying to detect. So completely different depths. And then if you plot it in a different space of the features, then this is those things you're trying to classify. So we've been sort of working on this. It's a very classic problem in large catalogs to classify those things. But you're trying to push it a little further because we want to go much further. So we're trying to introduce uncertainties, which in typical machine learnings are not introduced. So we made this thing called a deep ensemble network, which is a set of different deep neural network, which we put a Monte Carlo of label data sets as an input and an output. We know what they are according to the noise distribution of the input. And machine learning's methods, supervised learning methods especially, have this tendency to be sensible to the representativity of the data set. So, for example, those two distributions that I've shown before, you might build a really good, you can build a really good model that will map if the distribution are exactly the same, but as soon as they depart from each other, then it becomes a little more difficult. So we wanted to sort of quantify this, how much we can actually trust this. And so that's what's going on here. This is for example, the accuracy that we get depending on how much the distribution is similar according to the similarity distribution between the two, the label and label data set. This is just work in progress, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but I'll be happy to answer questions. One thing I'll spend more time on is spectroscopy. So not only in photometry, like I mentioned before, but spectroscopy has been a really large, has been seen really large surveys lately. Notably with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the Apogee mission in the infrared has been collected a few hundred of thousands of spectra. And the idea here is if you take a 2D image, or this is a raw 2D image, that's why you get a few hundreds of spectra in a 2D image. Then you try to project it to do a 1D spectra. And then from this 1D spectra, you can apply physical models that you sort of know to measure the abundances and of the chemical abundances of the stars, and the temperature, the surface, gravity, and metallicities of which characterize your model. So I'm not really a stellar astrophysicist at all, but I've been working with a stellar astrophysicist who know much more than me about it. And they were spending a lot of time determining this, and it's becoming really a human error prone to do it in a few hundred thousands of spectra like that. So this is the typical path from the raw 2D image to the kind of physics you can get with stellar population, galactic archaeology, or near-field cosmology from those spectra. The hope is that you can do at least some of it with machine learning, meaning to start with, let's do if we can do with calibrated spectra all the way maybe to at least the stellar parameters. And the typical previously analysis would go to the other way, would not start from the spectra, but start from the features, which are the parameters. But this is not the hard part. This is actually the fun part. So you don't want to really remove this one. So traditional approach, for example, here, we have a spectrum taken with Gemini, another telescope which the Canadians have access to, and Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And this is measuring those absorption features that you can see those deep absorption feature here. And then you have to match it to a physical model that predict those absorption features. You have to see which line absorbs, which line corresponds to which, and you have to decide the wavelength region. You have to remove a continuum. Here you don't see it, it's already removed. But all those things are quite labor intensive, and it would take maybe 2 weeks to do a few spectra before. You would measure the equivalent width of each of them, and then you will have fairly noisy measurements for each of the equivalent widths. So there are some many methods to do it. One of them is data-driven, but assuming that you previously have measured them somehow before. So we've tried to automate the full process of estimating all those abundances and stellar parameters with taking a 1D spectra and put it into a convolutional neural network, and then see whether we can measure a few things. So a convolutional neural network basically takes some part of the spectra and convolve it with different filters to create some what we call feature maps in between. And then at the end, you can relate things all together with all those local feature maps that you've done with a what we call a fully connected network, and then get your parameter out. So it's really the way we apply this here is just a bunch of spectral input, bunch interesting parameters outputs, and then let's see what the big interpolator will do. So it's been quite, we've tried a few things. We tried to do it with synthetic data, training on synthetic data, so that means trained by synthetic simulations, and see if it was producing well, it was working fine. And then we tried it with real data, and then see how the pipeline from this Apogee data set would actually, we would produce the same thing. And then it looks like it was quite successful here. We see the residual between the what we predicted with our conventional network versus the official pipeline, and then with the different distribution of signal to noise. We tried also, so this was trained on the pipeline data. Now this one is trained on synthetic. Sorry, I reversed it. So this training is synthetic. It has, but we tested on the actual data with the official pipeline. The scatter is a little, it's a little larger, but it's still pretty good. The scatter is larger mostly because I don't think the convolutional neural net is capable of modeling some instrumental effect that were taken into account in the official pipeline. This is sort of something we're sort of working on now and see if we can actually augment our data set with instrumental signatures. We have, I'm not going to spend too much time on that. It's is the fidelity of what we can get. So it's called a color magnetic diagram, or a Keel diagram, actually. But you have the metallicity gradient, and then you have the temperature and the surface of all those different stars, and they're supposed to follow those isochrones. And if all our parameters that we estimate follow it nicely. As you can see on the right, though, those convolutional neural networks, we overplotted on the right, those little yellow dots are all the training stars. So it requires a lot of training stars to actually make sense of all this correlation between all these different things there. So this is a limitation that we can see now. We can see physically, you can get some information from this. So this is, if you take the derivative of the spectra in function of the chemical abundances of the stars, and then you average in it with a few hundred, and actually it was a few thousand stars, and then so there would be the amount of information on the y-axis in given the each abundances on the stars. So you can do it from synthetic modeling. This is fine. But if you do it from a thing that is actually data driven, you can see you can actually get a slightly more information in some lines which were not picked up by the synthetic model. So this is maybe a good tool to actually increase our comprehension of the synthetic modeling. Going a little further on that topic, this is all fine. So machine learning and statistical modeling have been sort of fighting over the years, but it's sort of merging now with this the way that a lot of practitioners of machine learning want to have proper uncertainties, want to have more generative modeling aspect of the physical parameters. So this is a really experimental stuff we're trying to do now with it, and we get we starting to collaborate with people at UVic doing computer vision and machine learning as well. We show us like this thing called generative adversarial network. It's a bit complex, but anyway, I can show you on the pictures, for example, how this it applies. So on the left side, you have a bunch of pictures, and on the right side, this is something that this generative adversarial network will produce by itself. So yeah, you have a daily picture of car driving, and it's by learning all these from different pictures that somehow I can put some nights into this, and then this is what you can do. So the way it does it, so it sort of model everything inherently in what we call a latent space, and so it is capable from that latent space to which is a reduced, compressed the data. Feature data sets that is capable of generating a whole bunch of pictures that are not at completely random, but that sort of fits the reality. So there's literature of a million different methods. So we got sort of lost into this, but fortunately with the collaboration, we sort of got guided. How could we apply that with spectra? The idea was we know that synthetic modeling is actually limited in our understanding of stellar astrophysics. But we also know that sometimes our instrumental modeling is limited. So can we actually combine all together in a shared latent space and then reproduce either the synthetic modeling or also the reconstructed thing? And this is what is sort of displayed here. Between X1 would be the synthetic modeling, X2 would be the observed, and it goes through what we call an autoencoder, each different way, but it shares the same space. So it's a hybrid modeling, generative modeling, that we can, and then it reconstructs things. X22 is X2 is the model. X22 is the reconstructed model from the generative space. the latent space, and X11 here is the reconstructed observed one. You can actually compare them directly on that. Anyway, this is just from Friday, so it's really recent. This takes a while to train those things. We put a few hundred thousand spectra into the thing. So what can we simulate and observe this way? So X1 is simulated, X2 the observed. You can see, for example, there's this feature in the middle here, which is not really properly modeled on the observed one. But when you do the X11 simulated, first of all, it's capable of reconstructing properly the latent space, the simulation. And this is the model observed. And then these things are called adversarial models, that the model is trying to make sure that it doesn't reconstruct something fake, if you want. So this is work going on. We have some other work at CADC where we have millions of images from CFHT, for example, and then it's really time consuming to assess them. Because sometimes you get an image and you can spend time reducing it, where just by looking at it, you know exactly that there's a wrong. So we've done that in the past, so we have a bunch of labels that we know those data are wrong, so we can sort of train a convolutional neural network and assess the data quality, which we can give later on to the astronomers. Again, this is still work in progress. I will talk. Yeah, one thing that might be interesting, people are actually trying to see galaxy mergers in our data. So on the left here, it's an image of a real galaxy merger. On the right is something that is actually simulated, and the idea is to retrieve all the galaxy mergers in a whole large survey, as I mentioned before. This is just a work that's been started. It's actually quite hard to gather a real data set that you could train something on.
How many of these have we observed?
Sorry?
How many galaxy mergers have we observed? Must be very few.
Yes, exactly. That's why I say it's hard, because it's going to be based mostly on simulation there.
You mean the training will be based on simulation? You don't have enough real data to train?
No.
And more real data?
No, not just from real data, no.
What about lensing?
Yes, so gravitational lensing, you're talking?
Yeah.
So strong lensing, yes, it produces images which are extremely complex also to detect, and there has been a tremendous amount of literature into detecting strong lenses and surveys using neural network. There was actually a competition among many people to see how we can do it in the future surveys. And most of the winning method were based on neural networks. Now, I'm going to switch to something else. I was thinking this 21 years ago, I started working with supernovae, but slowly the last 10 years has been quite reducing. How do we process distances to do a supernova? So here is the original Hubble diagram, not really interesting, but from 1929. This has evolved quite a bit, so this is basically a redshift versus distance. Original Hubble constant, I think, is of a few hundred, so with no errors, obviously. So switching in 98, there was this big result from two teams discovering the accelerating expansion of the universe. And basically, it was about detecting a bunch of supernovae at different redshifts. and it was the first time, well, not the first time, but it was a, you, it was the with the height which is supernovae that you can compute the distance from their luminosity, because as with assuming that the supernovae was somehow you could standardize their luminosity. And then from that, you can compute distances, and then from distances, you can say things about our universe, geometrically, and maybe also with the energy density content. So in 98, discovered that. The type 20 supernovae were actually dimmer than expected with regular matter-dominated universe. And then the expansion was actually accelerating. But now, what the idea is, this big acceleration? And is it confirmed with other observations, and the big $10 million multi-experiments thing is about what is the cause, what's causing this accelerated expansion of the universe? What is this dark energy causing it, or something else? So supernova 101 distances, the ID, so it's the standard Kendall ID. You have some light that you measure here fairly well, and then you can, and then you know how to sort of predict the light that is measured much further away. You can do it also with standard rulers with bioacoustical isolation, but I'm not going to talk about it. And this is to measure distances. The supernova that I'm going to talk about, the 1As, the ones which we think they're a little more standard than the other ones, in the way they have the reproducible luminosity. The thing is, we don't know what causes a type 1A, whether they're coming from the progenitor is two white dwarfs and then inspiring and coalescing and merging, or maybe it's a one white dwarf accreting data from a red giant, accreting and not data. Accreting from a red giant, re-triggering a thermonuclear explosion. Before, the observational data was pointing more towards the second scenario, the red giant and the white dwarf. Now it points more towards the double white dwarf scenario. They're very bright, they're fast. You have to really detect them in less than 20 days at rest frame, so a higher redshift is a little different. It's a little more. And they're very rare, only one per million per galaxy. Since you're observing many millions of galaxies, that makes it feasible. So the way you measure distances here, you have to measure the flux of this of the supernovae, and then you just take the luminosity distance, knowing, making an assumption on the intrinsic luminosity of the supernova. Here, the idea is the intrinsic luminosity is not determined by the models, which I just told you we don't know about, but it's statistically average over all the supernovae that we can find. And then you get the redshift from the spectroscopy and the identification as well. So this is how you can then, once you have the distance, you can compare it with cosmological models. And then this is where you can say whether the universe is accelerating or not, and the acceleration, whether it's due to the dark energy or something else. So I've been involved with this also after the SCP. I was involved also in the Supernova Legacy Survey, which was on the Canadian and French Hawaii Telescope. And it's been quite successful follow-up of the... it's quite successful in detecting a lot of supernovae between redshift 0.2 and 0.9 over 4 square degrees, really deep fields. I was actually checking the CDC the other day, and some of the fields now have been observed so many times, we have over 600 hours, over 15 years of observation, that we could do actually do probably something much more than just supernovae. Then you have, then you detect light curves, and then we had also you have 10,000 different light curves, 1,000 different spectra, and this is well, a picture of the camera at the MegaCam, which is still observing now. We had telescope success for CFHT, as I mentioned, but also all those 8-meter telescopes in Chile and Hawaii. So lots of telescope time, many people, about 40 people over Canada, France, Portugal, England. I think this is mostly it. Must be forgetting people. The US, obviously. The idea here is to detect really quickly the supernovae. But since it's the same field, you detect them over and over and over and over. We call it the rolling strategy, which compared to the previous surveys. This is all fairly old stuff, but we still, the reason I have to go through this, because we have some late results. To find supernovae, so you have this really large field, and then you still have to find something. So where how do you do this? This is a zoom, for example, of the 1 square degree, and then I know exactly where the supernova was. It was one of the spectacular ones. Not too far, because you can see fairly well on that picture. What you do then, you stack a bunch of you co-add, realign, registrate, and co-add together a bunch of images together from one epoch, for each epoch, and multi different bands, and then you compare it with the high signal-to-noise template that you have done before the detection, at least a month before the detection, and then you correct for the point spread function. You can match them to match the point spread function of the different images. Then finally you can subtract, and then it's the easy part. You just run a filter detector on a subtracted image. You have to do this. This is fairly big data, because each exposure is 18 times 18,000 pixels. And then you have to detect that within a couple days, knowing that you have a few terabytes of data to process through. Back in 2005, if we had to put this directly at the telescopes, and it was sort of challenging to veto our candidates and send them to spectroscopy to be identified fairly quickly. Now, it could be all done in the cloud, I guess, and ship it to the cloud and process it there quickly. Spectroscopy, once you have your candidate, you make a list of candidates, you go, you can match it to supernova templates, which give you the redshift, the age, more or less, and the galaxy fraction that contaminates your spectrum. Mostly the redshift.
The template usually that's used is what? It's a spectrum, it's the standard candle template and the redshift.
So it's an average of various. There's supernova, not exactly standard candle, so there's like subclasses. So you would take subclasses, you would make an average of subclasses and match the one that fits the best your supernova.
Yeah, but then doesn't that introduce errors in the determination of your Z and your?
No, the Z is also determined is more from the galaxy too.
Oh, okay. So there's independent.
Then you can compare the Z of the galaxy and the supernova to see if they match together.
Okay.
What's a little hard also is how do you do the precise photometry after the fact? So, like I was saying, you could have up to 900 different hours, 600 different hours now. But mostly like a few thousands of images of the same field. And then you have to zoom on a specific point, knowing that you have all these observational difference between all those images. So We spent quite a bit of time with the team in Paris as well to develop these. Sometimes it's called scene modeling, sometimes it's called something else. Anyway, the idea is to do forward modeling of the field that you actually see, knowing the global properties of the image. And then you do it with all these few thousands of images simultaneously. You put this into a gigantic least square, and then you get your fluxes, your light curve at the end. By going with supernova, one of the things actually, we have some derived products, as I mentioned. One of the things is we're pushing the CCD limit pretty far to get really, really precise photometry. We want to have more or less a 2%, no, a 1% photometry on distance, which is more or less 0.2 in 0.02 in magnitude. So you have to compare supernova, which are extremely faint, a few photons per exposures, compared to stars, which are extremely bright, to calibrate your images. So stars, they overflow a CCD, and then they can be fairly large. Although the PSF, because the CCD is supposedly linear, should be exactly the same for really faint stars, really faint objects like supernova, and really bright stars. And this is how you could calibrate all together. So by what we notice is if you measure the width of a star, and then you compare it with the flux that you measure, and then we sort of measure that little by little, actually the size of the star would increase with the flux, which is not was expected. And we sort of post-corrected this thing and then didn't think about it. But then the group in Paris took it further and tried to replicate this experimentally, how if you can actually measure those bright objects compared to really small ones. And they were able to model this with a physical model, how to, for example, when you stack the CCD, the different pixel with a bunch of photon, it will create a large stack that would, after the successive photon, would actually be repulse and fall into the next pixels. That creates sort of small correlation. It's a small effect, so we're talking a 0.5% effect on the photometry. But this is being replicated, and every CCD that they have been seen so far, and it's one of the things that people want to do with the dark energy that they're correcting with the surveys, like the dark energy survey and even LSST. Back to distances. Back to distances, I'm going to go quickly here. I think people have seen this supernova stuff so many times, I'm not really sure. Back to distances, you can. How do you measure distances? Once you have the flux that you measure so precisely. So you fit a light curve model that you reconstruct from many, many, many different spectra and also many, many different light curves. You put all together and then you're trying to see what makes the variance between supernova to supernova. And what makes the variance from supernova to supernova are two different things. Besides the flux, the distances, meaning the flux at maximum, for example, which is here the MB one, the apparent magnitude, but also the width of the light curve and the color of the supernova are the two main things that differentiate supernova to supernova. And that's how you can go and make them reproducible standard candle. If you don't correct for either the width of the light curve, the stretch, or the color, that's what you get when you fit your cosmology, and then you see the residual versus, for example, the stretch, you would see that there is something missing. And if you just fit your cosmology and you make your residual versus the color only, but not the stretch, then you'll see also some correlation. So this is purely empirical relation. It's not so clear at least for Stretch, how it, it originates physically from the progenitors of the supernova. The latest diagram from the SNLS was from 2014, which was a joint collaboration with the SDS Sloan Digital Sky Survey tool. And this is the Hubble diagram, so redshift versus distance. And it was a fairly intense calibration experience, trying to calibrate all these different surveys all together, putting them on the same scale. The nice thing, because we try to make a joint calibration, that supernova back in a few years back were more plagued with systematics concerning the calibration. And with the joint calibration thing, now we're back on the same scale, statistical error and systematic error. So we're back hopefully on measuring distances a little more accurately. So those are the results when you plot it in the traditional cosmological space, the density of matter versus the W, which I haven't talked about here, actually, which is the equation of state parameter, which is what basically tells you whether you live in this universe, maybe propagated with a cosmological constant, or maybe something else. So you want to try to see whether it's different than -1 here on the left. And you cannot say it only from supernova, which is the blue contour. You have to make some assumption, and then you especially have to combine it with other cosmological survey like the Planck mission to make those really tiny contours. And then this is how you get the equation of state being at 5% accuracy, precision. And it includes systematics as well. If you try to see how much this equation of state evolved with redshift, then it becomes everything super noisy. So those results here are just for fun, really, on the right. Now, what can we do more? So now we're going through, after all these years, we're still processing the 5 years data of the supernova legacy survey. And then what can we do more? The idea is the supernova actually have some influence from the local environment? So here, the idea is to measuring the whole galaxy of where the supernova exploded way past the explosion, and then see and measure the total flux of the galaxy, the global properties of the galaxy, and measure it precisely at the location where the supernova exploded. So this requires, again, very highly precise position of the supernova, which we got from those fancy algorithms to measure the photometry. And then making extremely deep stack of all the exposure together to get those images of the galaxy and measure the photometry and compare the two together. So this has been a sort of a debate among the supernova group. Could we use the environment as a third parameter? You had the stretch and the color. Maybe you could correct also for the environment. And what we see, if the local environment actually plays a role, especially when you go, the really local environment plays a role rather than the global environment of the supernova. So if you measure the photometry, as I mentioned, and then you propagate back to the best frame, that so you have a proxy here on the x-axis, the U minus V local. This is proxy for age, basically, of the super, where the super, the environment where the supernova exploded. And then on the left, this is the Hubble residual. You can see a slight slope between between this. So this is maybe considered as a as a third parameters. Now, so why is it important for cosmology? This is, also, by the way, done with a full survey of the SNLS. And why is it important for cosmology? Because ultimately, it might have impact to 1% on the equation of state. But maybe this is, has been controversial, the Hubble constant tension that people have seen so far between the CMB and the super, local supernova. So I'm just going to finish here and then leave you with some ideas that things we can do besides supernovae. Obviously, Hubble constant is one thing for the nearby one. Because supernovae are gone after a while or we're not there, we could also have lens supernovae and conclude dark matter properties using this. So this will be a big deal in the next, in the further surveys like the Tsuiki transient factory or the LSST, which are coming online fairly soon. You could gravitational, you take, still with nearby supernovae, test gravitational theories with peculiar motions, where the, with nearby supernovae, the peculiar motion becomes more important. So the peculiar motion that relative to the Hall's galaxy, they would you can measure how the supernova will have you could sort of make a flow of the supernova with the clusters of the galaxy it comes it exploded in, which you cannot do at higher redshift because you're not resolving the.
Yeah. But then, how you're testing gravitational theory?
So this I am not a specialist, but apparently you could test a large scale structure with the growth of structure using peculiar motion like that.
At galactic scales, I guess.
Yeah.
Well,
you could measure this sigma 8 apparently with this. the progenitors, the nuclear astrophysics, whole bunch of astrophysics. I was just thinking of the gravitational time thing that someone presented before. This is something we can we actually measure in supernova as well. That how, with redshift, the light curve of the supernova at 0.1, the redshift 0.1 or redshift of 0.7 is actually quite different. And if you don't correct for this, you're not getting any of your distances. Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Options? Okay.
It doesn't trigger.
I think, okay, class dismissed. okay, so yeah, let's thank Sebastian.
Okay.